Good evening and welcome to today's special program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is co-presented by The Nation magazine. I'm Ladaris Cordell, retired judge of the Superior Court of California, former police auditor for the city of San Jose, and your moderator for this program. 2015 marks the 150th birthday of The Nation magazine. To commemorate this historic anniversary, we are proud to present a conversation about our country's inequality crisis, a pressing issue impacting millions of Americans, and a core nation issue on which the magazine has long been sounding the alarm. The wealth controlled by the top 10th of the top 1% has more than doubled over the past 30 years in the United States, approaching unprecedented levels. San Francisco, where we are holding today's program, most certainly symbolizes the inequality issue. The city has been racked by battles over development, a homeless population that spills onto its sidewalks, rocketing housing costs, and increases in crime. With its gleaming new buildings and influx of Silicon Valley wealth, San Francisco has the fastest growing income inequality gap in the nation. So what does this inequality mean for the political process, for the environment, living wages, and immigrant rights, and in turn for civil society and the future of our democracy? Tonight, we will have a conversation with four prominent experts about key problems afflicting America through the lens of the unprecedented concentration of wealth in the United States today. And now, please welcome our panelists. First, Robert Reich is Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley and Senior Fellow at the Blum Center for Developing Economies. He served as Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration and was named by Time magazine as one of the 10 most effective cabinet secretaries of the 20th century. His latest book is Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. Please welcome Robert Reich. Welcome. Oh, wow. Ai-Jen Poo is director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and co-director of the Caring Across Generations campaign. She was a 2014 MacArthur Genius and was named one of the world's most 100 influential people by Time magazine. She is a 2013 World Economic Forum Young Global Leader and author of The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. Please welcome Ai-Jen Poo. Van Jones is an environmental advocate, civil rights activist, and he is the co-founder of four nonprofit organizations, including Rebuild the Dream, of which he is president. He is also a CNN political contributor. Van is a Yale-educated lawyer, and in 2009 worked as the Green Jobs Advisor to President Obama. He is the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Rebuild the Dream. Please welcome Van Jones.
Oh, hello, Van.
Right, my friend.
Woo-hoo.
Our final panelist, Katrina VandenHeuvel, is the editor and publisher of The Nation. She is a frequent commentator on TV and radio, the author of numerous books, and a weekly online columnist for The Washington Post. Her blog appears at thenation.com. Please welcome Katrina VandenHeuvel. So we're going to start our conversation with a question I'm going to just throw out to all of you. In a 2014 Pew survey, inequality was America's top choice for greatest threat to the world. All of the presidential candidates, Democrat and Republican, are talking about inequality. I give you a quote here. The rich have gotten richer, income inequality has gotten worse, and there are more people in poverty than ever before. Those words were the words of Mitt Romney. So panelists, are we finally at the tipping point? Are Americans, left and right, rich and poor of all hues, are we all now in agreement that our economic and political systems are rigged and they have to change? Is all of the anger about inequality now the great unifier? Are we about to tip? Jump in.
No. Should I explain?
Yes.
I think that the good news is that inequality is something that people are talking about. I think that after years of seeing inequality widen, the median wage stagnate, the poor and the poverty level be stubbornly high, and the rich get richer, finally we are getting to a tipping point, even among Republicans, where it's at least expected, we're fashionable to say something about it. But we are not anywhere near doing anything significant about it. There is one candidate, I believe, who is talking seriously about it, and a few others who are being influenced by him. But I don't want to make this into a partisan forum.
Yeah.
My biggest fear, honestly, is that we may be, as a nation, heading into a world war. And war can bring out either the best or the worst in nations. It sometimes can lead to, paradoxically, a great deal of social solidarity. And some very good things can come out of the horrors of war in terms of the issue of inequality, but it also can bring out some terrible ugliness. And we've got to watch that very, very carefully.
Anybody else?
Well, I think there's other good news, which is that everywhere I turn, I see low-wage workers in motion. I see incredible organizing among fast food workers, home care workers, domestic workers. You've all heard of the Fight for 15, Walmart workers, retail workers, even the baristas at Starbucks. People are coming together, and I think that combined with the incredible vibrancy of the movement for Black Lives, there is this sense of collective self-confidence, I think, that people who are on the front lines of inequality in this country are starting to express that we actually can turn the tide on this and that we are going to come together and build the kind of movement necessary to do so. Mm. And that, to me, is the best news in this situation. And Frances Fox Piven, the great historian of social movements, told me not long ago that she does believe that we are in the early stages of what will be the next great social protest movement of this country that will fundamentally transform democracy for all of us. And, you know, she's right about a lot of things, so I'm going to go with that.
Well.
Well, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
I just want to
I'm not 150, but thank you.
But if it had gone out on your watch, we'd be talking bad about you. So congratulations.
Thank you.
You know, I think that you're right. There's an agreement about problem, not agreement about solution. But there are right-wing populisms that are very interesting now in their willingness to take this on. Mm-hmm. They use terms different than those that are familiar to us, but you hear right-wingers now talking about what they call crony capitalism, and that's their way of talking about the way that the government has been captured to protect big corporations at the expense of working people. So I think there's a growing agreement and, frankly, growing militancy on the right and on the left. The problem is that the solutions put forward by the right would make things worse. I also think that when you listen to the orange guy, Trump.
The orange guy. Not Boehner, the orange guy.
Yeah.
Who did you have in mind?
Exactly.
Listening.
When you listen to him, there's something interesting happening where there's a style of politics that could be a precursor to something. In other words, this, I just don't give a dadgum anymore. I'm just not going to be polite. Now, they're doing it on the right, so we don't like it. But there's something that's happening where people who before felt both on the left and the right constrained, there's just not enough cookies on the table now for people to be polite. The temperature is going up for both the right and the left, so I do think that the income inequality debate and discussion is something we should be very, very observant for opportunities on the right that we might find more exciting than the ones we see right now.
So I agree with everything that's been said. I think the rules are being rewritten in different ways on the left and on the right, and at the heart of it, I think we're witnessing a discredited, failed status quo. Mm-hmm. This Washington consensus, inside the Beltway consensus, of deregulation, of corporate trade agreements, of failure to make public investments, of mandatory sentencing, all of this is coming under scrutiny and question. You see it in Bernie Sanders' campaign, you see it in Donald Trump's in different ways. The question is where will it head? Because it is no question a time of upheaval. And around the world, there are movements, like movements you're describing, both hopeful and not hopeful, whether it's in Greece and Spain or in Canada. But where it will end is going to require political power and movements.
Well, let's pick up on that, because let's pick up on the political power issue. So, first of all, this talk about inequality, it's been around for years. I mean, in the 1930s, Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis once noted, we can have a democracy or we can have great wealth in the hands of a few, but we cannot have both. And in 1956, The Nation published an article by W.E.B. Du Bois in which he wrote, corporate wealth profits as never before in history. We turn over the national resources to private profit and have few funds left for education, health, or housing. So if we talk about politics, there's a boatload of money in the lobbying industry. In 2013, if we just talk about Silicon Valley, Apple spent $3.3 million in lobbying. That's just in 2013. Amazon, $3.4 million. Facebook, $6.4 million. Microsoft, $10.4 million. And Google spent $15.8 million, all to influence politicians in Washington. So don't we have to rein in lobbying to achieve income inequality? And if so, how do we do that?
The answer is clearly we do, and we have to get big money out of politics. We have to reverse Citizens United. We have to make sure that there is... public financing of all campaigns, and also make sure that there's full disclosure of wherever the money is coming from. It's easy to say what we should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
It is extremely hard to get the power to do it because, you see, we face a chicken and egg problem. The people with power don't want fundamentally to lose power, and they fear that any fundamental change in how politics is financed would be a threat to them. So let's go back to the issue of populism, because it really is the core question here. We see on the right and the left upheavals, angry, frustrated, anxious people all across America and also across Europe and many other places around the globe. This is not just an American problem. But the question is how that anger is utilized. What political leaders and political movements and political organization is going to do with that anger? And this is the great challenge, it seems to me. Because if we are facing a common threat in the form of radical jihadism, whatever you want to call it, that anger can be turned into something positively, maybe creative, or it can be turned into fierce xenophobia and racism and ethnic exclusivity. We have got to take a leadership role in making sure that that anger is channeled in a positive direction. And everybody in this hall has got to do exactly the same thing.
Anyone else?
Oh, I want to say a couple things about this. I mean, first of all, from an African-American perspective, that's an African-American, not the, but an African-American perspective, the conversation about inequality starts with mass incarceration. It starts there. And then moves to the rest of it. And I think it's very important to understand that, you know, Aijin mentioned the movement for Black Lives. I think that this is one of the most important developments of our time. Mm-hmm. A lot of people got mad because some kids grabbed some microphones or whatever, and that's their only point of reference, and they felt like they had to defend Bernie Sanders until the hill. Missing the entire movie. Mm-hmm. Missing the entire movie. You now have a generation of African Americans who are coming on the scene. They were 12 years old when Obama got in the office, 13, 14. They're not impressed with having a Negro president. They're not impressed with having a Democratic Party that will say stuff. They are facing incarceration rates that are six times their peers when they're doing the same things as their peers. In other words, Black kids and white kids do drugs the same amount. But white kids are, Black kids go to prison six times more than their white peers. And nobody's done anything about it. And you have a view of the state that the state itself does a better job of punishing than protecting. The state itself does a better job of hurting people than helping people. And that they see violence from the government inside the U.S. borders in the form of mass incarceration. Their peers see it at the U.S. border in the form of mass deportations. And all the young people see it beyond the U.S. border in the form of militarization. And so you have a seamless web of violence from the government that somehow does not protect them from the street-level violence, but it just enhances it. And no one's speaking for them. And then you have a Democratic Party that wants to open its mouth to talk about income inequality, but won't, until very recently, speak of these issues as integral to the fight. You can't have income inequality if you've been labeled a felon for doing what your kids are doing in college right now, and what some of you were doing this weekend. You can't have income inequality if you've been labeled a felon. You can't get a job, you can't get a student loan, you can't get an apartment, you can't get a business license. And so for those young people to hear a Democratic Party after 7+ years of Obama still not dealing with it, I was very impressed by them. The only force in American politics besides Hillary Clinton that both political parties had to address in their debates was Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter was started by three young women, a couple of whom work with you, with nothing but their pain and a hashtag. And they forced both parties to deal with them. We should celebrate that first, second, and third before we critique them at all.
So, let me just pick up just very briefly on this. So, you know, it appears that race is the weapon of choice by those who want to maintain the status quo and draw attention away from inequality. Because, I mean, if you listen, Donald Trump's battle cry is, let's make America great again. That's just dog whistle politics, mm-hmm. isn't it not? Isn't it code for let's make America white again? So the question is the Black Lives Matter movement focusing enough on income and wealth inequality? Should it be doing more in that area? This is for anybody. What do you...
No, I don't think they should be doing more. You have a Democratic Party. I just want to...
Do you think there's one Democratic Party, though? Because I think what's emerged in the last years, post-Occupy, post-crash, and I might even argue post-Obama, is that there has been a war within the Democratic Party, the war between the Wall Street wing and the more corporate establishment wing, which often both wings have failed to take into account what you're talking about, though you could argue that if activism has any worth, carrots and sticks, the sticks applied rightly to Bernie Sanders this summer, or even the consciousness raising done for Senator Warren, people are speaking in new ways, but that battle goes on and it's going to determine, to a certain extent, the direction of the inequality discussion in this country.
Look, the way I see it, and I'd love to get the views of others, but the way that I see it is that the visible fight in the party is between the Wall Street wing and the white economic populace. And I don't mean white in some derogatory, I just mean if you look at the rallies, those are majority white rallies. The problem that you have is that at the end of the day, the Republicans and the right wing of the Democrats want black people to settle for trickle-down economics. And the left wing of the Democratic Party wanted us to settle for trickle-down justice. In other words, you shut up, we're not gonna say black, we're not gonna talk about your issues, we're not gonna talk about prisons, you shut up. We are gonna talk about taxing Wall Street, fixing Social Security, and income inequality. And you'll get yours, don't worry.
And not invest in schools, prisons, or exactly, giving families a second
and
third chance after
exactly,
prisons.
And not even, to your point, and not even raising the slogans of schools, not jails,
right.
Not raising the slogans of ending mass incarceration, not raising the slogans of speaker name, and as a result, you have a third leg in the progressive movement, which is the racial justice leg, which has no home and has no candidate. And you're talking about the Dreamers on the Latino side, the Black Lives Matter movement, you're talking about Idle No More among Native Americans. You have a racial justice third wing of the party with no candidate and no voice and not even the pretense of a black candidate to mask all of that, and they exploded into public view. Mm-hmm. And I think they brought out, frankly, the best in both wings. And I have to say, I was very, very proud of those young people and very, very proud of the way that Bernie Sanders himself righted himself and responded with such compassion. He was taken aback, but he responded with compassion. And I think these young people have brought out the best in both wings of the party. And I no longer hear trickle-down justice from the white progressive populace. I think that's a very, very healthy thing that they achieved.
I think that what has happened is that, and again, I don't know precisely what's going on inside any campaign or inside the Washington precincts of the Democratic Party, but I think that gradually a dawning realization is occurring that if you have progressives, and they are white progressives, they can't maintain or get an electoral majority, but if you have the progressives, along with people of color, Latinos and blacks, you can actually create a majority in America. And that coalition, if you actually can generate that coalition, is a winning coalition. Now, what the Democrats have done since Franklin D. Roosevelt was to exclude African Americans,
mm-hmm. That's right.
Very consciously, very carefully. That was FDR's coalition. That was the white working class and whoever else he could find to muster, and a very, very direct exclusion of the Southern African-Americans, the Southern blacks. That has been the policy of the Democratic Party all the way up until, I would say, Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton tried to have a larger coalition, but the error of Bill Clinton was Katrina,
was bringing in and making an alliance with the Wall Street Democrats. Yeah, yeah. And that undermined everything else. That made it very difficult to actually create a new progressive movement. So the question for the Democrats and the question for Hillary Clinton and for Bernie Sanders and anybody else, Martin O'Malley, is whether they are willing to abandon the Wall Street part of their coalition and join in a new winning coalition with people of color. That is the central strategic question. And to my mind, the only way we get any kind of change in America is if the Democrats choose the latter, not the former.
So if you have these coalitions, let's say we can actually get people together, voting is the bottom line. Voting is critical to an egalitarian society. And that said, in America, low voter turnout is the rule, not the exception. Bernie Sanders wants everyone to be automatically registered to vote at age 18. But that still doesn't address the issue of getting people to actually vote. In Australia, people are fined for not voting. So given how low our voter turnout is in this country, should we do the same? Should we penalize people for not voting? Or are there other ways to get people to go to the polls?
Judge, I'd flip it a little. I think the crisis we're witnessing is something related to what Bob just spoke about, which is there isn't the coalition that, the Rising American Coalition, the Republicans, the right, sees that, and they are doing everything in their power to suppress the vote, to suppress this coming shift in our country's demography, destiny, politics. The money that is pouring into suppressing the vote is staggering. It is akin to a new poll tax, to a Jim Crow. I think it will take movements to get out the vote. I'm not in favor of mandatory voting. I can be persuaded, but I'm thinking, Reverend Barber in North Carolina, Moral Mondays, has made a commitment to devote his movement to get out the vote, multiracial, multi-justice, multi-issue, and toward what he calls a third Reconstruction. The civil rights movement of the 60s having been the second. And in that third Reconstruction, rallying people not only in North Carolina, but he is going to travel this country speaking about everything from healthcare to mandatory minimums, to justice, to mass incarceration, to fast food workers. So I just think there's something in that motion, but we should be aware of the money that has been pumped in, and that should be disclosed. My last point, I think all contributions to super PACs should be 100% taxable, and the money should go to universal voter registration. This state has done a good thing.
Does anyone on the panel here think that voting should be mandatory?
I certainly don't. I think people will vote when they have something to vote for. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that part of it is a question of the agenda. And if we could create an agenda for the future of this country where the full diversity of who we are and who we're becoming as a nation and our interests and how they're interconnected could be articulated and reflected back in a very compelling agenda that's not imprisoned by the politics of the possible, but actually about what people need mm-hmm. in this country to not only survive, but to thrive. And not just some people, all people. And I think when we have that agenda, we will see a desire to engage in a different way.
So, both of my grandmothers were the help. They had low wages, they had no health care, they had one day off a week, it was a Thursday, long days. Today's domestic workers include large numbers of immigrant women who, unlike my grandmothers, had organizations like IGEN's National Domestic Workers Alliance to advocate for them. So IGEN, your focus, and Van, yours as well, has been upon grassroots organizing. But there are some who believe that this is the wrong approach and that the way to think about eradicating inequality is by looking down, not up. So a conservative pundit recently said the following: the problem in America is not wealth, but persistent poverty. Don't punish the rich. Help the poor become richer. You know, like the song we all heard at the beginning from Finian's Rainbow, make the idle poor become the idle rich. So, Ai-Jen, what's your view on that? Is grassroots going about it the wrong way?
Well, so ever since the 1930s, when our labor laws were put into place as part of the New Deal, and a deal was cut, Southern members of Congress refused to sign on to the National Labor Relations Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act if they included farm workers and domestic workers, who were black workers at the time. Robert mentioned this. And those bills were passed with those exclusions in place in a concession to those Southern members of Congress. And so for more than 75 years, domestic workers and farm workers have been excluded from the core foundation of our labor protections. And the only thing that has changed that over time, more than seven decades, the only thing that has changed that is domestic workers organizing at the grassroots level, led by Dorothy. Yes. Yes. The first round was in the 70s, a domestic worker from Atlanta named Dorothy Bolden, a black woman, courageous national heroine, led the National Domestic Workers Union and won inclusion of some domestic workers in minimum wage protections. And this generation of domestic workers who's organizing in 30 cities around the country today has won domestic worker bills of rights in six states in the last 5 years. So we are indeed changing policy and the course of history through grassroots organizing, and that really has been the only thing that has worked. So that's what I would say to them.
Ben?
Well, first of all, I think we should give a round of applause to Ai-Jen for her incredible work. You know, I wouldn't dare to add to what she said. There's just not going to be, and you've already seen it, even liberal elites like ourselves just don't have the fingertips for what's really going on all too often. So we're often trying to solve the wrong problem at the wrong time, and you need, whether you talk about Occupy Wall Street, mm-hmm. or the movement for Black Lives, or this new labor movement that's coming up, is breaking all the rules. I mean, everybody applauds Ai-Jen now. I hope I'm not offending anybody, but you were not the darling of progressives 3 or 4 years ago when you were driving these, you know, young, brown, immigrant women into the halls of power. That was very weird. And people didn't know what to make of it. And people poo-pooed it, and they were patronizing, and all of a sudden you won in three or four states mm-hmm. and extended more rights to more people than anybody, your movement, not you personally, but your movement extended more rights to more people quicker than anything that's happened in the past 40 years, and possible exception of the farm workers. This is what happens when the people who are at the boot heel stand up. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, we got a bunch of young people here from the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights and other places. Look, when I was young, pissed off with, you know, dreadlocks and, you know, cops bothering me, my ideas were much more militant. You know, now I'm, you know, old and on TV and cops are nice to me. I find myself kind of in that very frustrating, well, you know, on the one hand or on the other hand. And then these Black Lives Matter kids came and kicked us all in the butt and said, screw you, we're getting messed over. So I just think that there's something to be said for the contribution that's made by people who have an actual dog in a race.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton does not want a system that will provide a free college education for everyone. She said, I don't want to pay for the education of Donald Trump's children. Well, neither do I. But is she on to something, or should college or vocational education be free for all? And other countries do it, so why not here?
Well, I think that it's very important in terms of the building the kind of coalition we're talking about, mm-hmm. And gaining the kind of grassroots support we're talking about, to seek a kind of a system in which not only is public higher education free, and I don't think Donald Trump's children would go to public higher education institutions, but also that we have a single-payer healthcare system. This is very important. Now, we may not be able to get this next week or next year or in a couple of years, but it's something to aspire to. It builds and enlarges social solidarity. It creates the kind of links between the poor and the middle class, between blacks and whites and Latinos, between Americans generally, that can support this kind of set of institutions. And the fight is going to be long and bitter and difficult, but building on something Dan, you said before, I've just returned from several weeks in red America, in red states and red cities. You may wonder what I was doing there. What was that? I was trying to flog a book. I didn't do very well in the red states or red cities, but what I did discover, I had a meeting with a bunch of small farmers in Missouri, who were organizing against some of the big agribusinesses and factory farms. These small farmers called themselves conservative Republicans, but they were organizing against what they considered to be and were, in fact, some of the forces that were systematically eating away at their profits and destroying the environment. You know, I met with small business leaders, not only in stature, no, they were actually tall, some of them, but they were but they were small business leaders and franchisees in Cincinnati, and they were organizing against some of the big businesses and big franchisors who were, again, undermining their profits and monopolizing. And across the red America, I kept on running into people who were organizing against the powerful, the wealthy, the monopolists. The Fight for 15 people that I met in St. Louis and in Kansas City are doing exactly the same thing. And these people have got to be linked up. The moral majority, the Moral Monday people, not majority, Moral Monday
people. They are
people,
the true moral majority.
who I met in Raleigh. They are also beginning to link up with some of these conservative Republican groups about the same issues of power and wealth.
So I think there is a transpartisan movement here to be built on. And you've been writing about it, Bob, because I think there's so much in our history we could retrieve. There's so much radical history, which is why when Bernie Sanders talks about Denmark, I have no problem with Denmark, because we retrieve some of that history in our own country. But the idea of trust busting, we need to revive that. The idea, I think if you recall years ago, in the fight against media concentration and for media democracy, a fight the nation was very central to, you had Trent Lott align with Code Pink, because both didn't like the bigness. They wanted localism and diversity. And I think there's a real suspicion of bigness, of corporate bigness, that if the Tea Party hadn't been so racist, you could have found some possible alliances there. But you've written about this. I'm not sure I fully agree, but you're saying that the future of American politics is between the establishment and the anti-establishment.
Well, we find...
I'm thinking they're within
there are two anti-establishments now vying for
And that's interesting. And that's
we're finding in the work that I do, I mean, there's something called the Green Tea Movement.
Is that right? I know about the coffee party.
The coffee party is liberals.
And the black tea movement.
That's in Oakland. we're allied with them in Green for All. There's the Green Tea Movement, and the argument that they make is, I think, very compelling. Shouldn't every American have the right and the liberty to power their own homes with their own power?
That's interesting.
Without being bossed and dictated to by utility companies that will tell you when you're going to pay your energy bill, how much it's going to cost, how many asthma inhalers you're going to have in your community as a result of it, and yet you don't have that right in America. And so there's a green tea movement of Tea Party people saying, we're tired of being bossed and dominated by government monopoly power companies telling us that we can't power our own homes with solar and sell that power on a public grid. That's one thing on the criminal justice side. I think it's very important to understand this. We're working very closely with the far right and the hard right on criminal justice issues. Newt Gingrich and I pulled together Newt Gingrich and I pulled together a summit. We said if we get 100 leaders together in Washington, D.C., left and right, for 1 hour on criminal justice, we could change everything. We didn't get 100. We got 700 for 7 hours in March, including 10 congresspeople, 3 governors, 2 cabinet secretaries, and President Obama sent a video, and that was in March. In February, people said criminal justice reform was impossible. Now they say it's inevitable, because it turns out that there's a conservative critique that says prisons are a big failed government bureaucracy. They gobble up money and liberties and do a horrible job. From a Christian point of view, they don't treat every soul with respect, and there's no redemption possible. And from a libertarian point of view, they're the enemy of individual liberty. You say, well, I don't trust these guys. And I say, well, hold on a second. Who do you trust? I can point to 3 Republican governors, Deal in Georgia, closing prisons, Perry in Texas, closing prisons, Kasich in Ohio, trying to close prisons. I can't name one Democratic governor in the country that's closed a prison, including your governor, Jerry Brown.
Cuomo.
Cuomo.
I'm not a fan, but Cuomo.
Cuomo got pulled into kicking and screaming. A compromise that would have been much better had he led on it. But even Deval Patrick, even Jerry Brown. My point is, this is just echoing and underscoring what's been said earlier. There's the temperature's rising.
Got it.
And there's a liberty and justice for all moment here. Liberty, that's the Republicans, limited government, all that sort of stuff. Justice, that's us, don't pick on little people. There's a liberty and justice for all moment coming that I do think that we might find some areas of overlap.
So you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program. Tonight's program is co-presented by The Nation magazine in commemoration of their 150th anniversary, and we are discussing inequality in America. Our speakers are Robert Reich, professor and former U.S. Secretary of Labor, Ai-Jen Poo, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, Van Jones, former White House Special Advisor for Green Jobs and CNN commentator, and Katrina VandeHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation. I am Ladaris Cordell, retired judge of the Superior Court of California, former police auditor for the City of San Jose, and your moderator. And you can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. We're at a point where we want to go to questions that have been submitted from the audience, but before we do that, let's do a quick inequality jeopardy round. So I'm going to give a quote about inequality to you all up here, and you tell us who said it. And remember, your answer has to be in the form of a question. So if you don't know for sure the answer, just take a good guess at it. It'll be fine. All right, here we go. First quote, Republicans are for both the man and the dollar, but in case of conflict, the man before the dollar. Take a guess.
Ted Cruz.
All right. Anybody else? All right, the answer?
Andrew Carnegie, no.
The answer? Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, you guessed. You
take all right.
Well, it's almost Ted Cruz. Almost. It has a
All right, next one. If you can't get rich dealing with politicians, then there's something wrong with you.
Willie Brown.
Willie Brown, he said.
That's good. That's good.
You be careful. You know what city you're in. You just be careful.
Close. The answer, Donald Trump.
Oh.
Two more. Next one. The law in its majestic equality forbids the rich as well as the poor from sleeping under bridges, begging on the streets, and stealing bread.
Anatole
France, bingo. Yeah. Very good. Last one. Last one. Those are my principles. And if you don't like them, well, I have others. Anybody?
Richard Nixon.
Groucho Marx.
All right.
So now we will turn to questions from you all. Questions for you all. How do we give individuals enough power to be effective, but not enough to be corrupted?
Can we give a lifeline to Thelton Henderson? We have one of the great, we should give a round of applause, one of the great
federal judge, Thelton Henderson.
Judge Thelton.
Thank you.
Give a round of applause. Sir.
Who is the epitome of justice. Yeah. Absolutely. So how do we give people power, but not too much?
Look, it's all in the balance. And I'd love to actually hear, Aijin, I think you had some ideas from our early discussion, but listen, this is a dynamic system. People want to figure out, geez, you talk to these young people. I voted in 2008 and everything didn't get fixed. I quit. I mean, this is a dynamic system we're going to be continuing to interact with and try to improve and learning from for hopefully another 1,000 years. And so there is no one single answer or one single thing, because even if you fix it today, there's new technologies and new trickery tomorrow. And democracy is a practice, it's not an end state.
Mr. Rice, didn't you write in your book that it really isn't corruption, right? Didn't you say it's just people making rules?
Yes, I mean, the new form of corruption is, in fact, mostly very big institutions, large corporations, Wall Street, and also some very wealthy individuals who are buying their way into American politics in the form of changing the rules the way the market actually functions. They don't think of themselves as corrupt. They think that's just the way they have to lobby in order to maintain themselves and obey the principles of fiduciary obligation to their shareholders, but it's actually undermining the entire system. Back to your question, Your Honor. May I call you Your Honor?
I love it. Please do.
By the way, can we, as long as we're passing around appreciation, let me just appreciate you. Your public service has been exemplary. Thank you.
And you are both, it turns out, great artists. I did not realize, Your Honor, that you are, like Brother Reicher, an accomplished artist. So maybe the left brain and the right brain together can get us out of this thing.
I didn't realize.
Now, to get back to our questions here.
Can I say one thing on that point? I actually think if you look at the healthiest democracies around the world, one thing they have in common is really, really vibrant social movements. And so one of the most important things we can do is add oxygen to social movements, because I think that creates the context for good governance, in my view.
I think you're absolutely right. And the greatest enemy of social movements is cynicism.
That's right.
And every single time anybody detects any degree of cynicism about the capacity of politics and our democracy to function as it should, as it can, they are contributing to a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So, but to pick up on the cynicism, so it's very tricky in terms of media coverage, because we do a lot of investigations at The Nation, and you expose corruption, you expose abuse, in the hope that wrongs will be righted. But it can also lead to cynicism, and I think there's a balancing act there. I agree with you, it's not only cynicism, it's cynicism about the role of government. That is so much at the heart of it, because I've heard so many people, and they're right, say government has been captured. It's not working on behalf of the people. And they're right, but to throw it out is the wrong way to go. You want to take it back, clean it up, get it working, and show, it seems to me, the most important thing you can do in politics of all kinds, movements, electoral politics, is to show that you improve the condition of people's lives. Wage stagnation, you as Secretary of Labor, I mean, 40, 50 years, African American communities, white working class. It's brutal, and no attention really paid or no concern really shown until in these last years. That will turn people away from politics, from government, from a belief that government can work on behalf of a too often cited common good. But
I shouldn't have been sitting here, and I think she's holding out on us. Because we were talking about left-right stuff. You have been able to get people to come together on your issues in a way that I think has shocked a lot of people. And I thought you might have gotten to say something during that left-right conversation. Did you have any insight?
Thank you, Van.
Yeah.
I did. I was actually just going to say, I mean, I've been so inspired by Cut 50 and all the work you've been leading on mass incarceration. And, you know, I think that we just have to get smarter and more creative about how we are connecting the dots between and across the kinds of pain that people feel in this economy. And one of the things that we think about a lot is the fact that this country is actually aging. The baby boom generation is reaching retirement age at a rate of a person every 8 seconds. 10,000 people turn 65 per day. Some people call it the silver tsunami, the gray revolution.
I regret.
Yeah. So silence.
Why did somebody give me a microphone? No, he's here.
That's fine.
And it, what it's resulting in, well, and also because of advances in healthcare and technology, people are living longer than ever before. So people of my grandmother's demographic are the fastest growing demographic in the country, 85 and older. And so we are about to have the largest older population we've ever had in the history of this country.
Ah.
No, it's a good thing. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Look, living longer is loving longer, learning longer, connecting longer, if we have the right supports in place. And because of the huge demand, the need for caregivers is going through the roof. And we represent caregivers, right? The fastest growing occupation in the nation is home care. And the average annual median income for home care workers is $13,000 per year. So here you have a situation where millions of people, 27 million to be precise, by the year 2050, are going to need care just to meet their basic daily needs. And then you have an incredibly talented but overstretched and undervalued working poor workforce. If we could connect the dots, where we actually invest in a new care infrastructure and the ability for people to afford the care they need so that they can live independently, aged, connected to their communities, and this workforce that can support that independence actually gets invested in such that these jobs become good jobs for the future, mm-hmm. right? It's a win-win. People get to age in place and people get good jobs. Win-win, right? This is something. This is the kind of agenda, right, that connects people across race, class, generation, and ideology. And we just need that in a really comprehensive way in this country. So that instead of becoming increasingly polarized along lines of race and generation, we're actually turning towards each other and finding solutions at the places where our interests come together.
So let me pick up on that from a question from the audience. Why do the working class, the working poor, so often vote in defense of the 1%? In other words, vote against their best interests. And how might we change that?
I want to say something about that question. Here's the deal. I think this is a question that I wince at. It's a favorite question among liberals and progressives.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like it. And I'll tell you why I don't like it. There are people who vote against their economic self-interest. And they're the people in this room. if rich liberals voting for higher taxes to help poor people are voting against their economic self-interest. But nobody calls them stupid. You say, oh, but that's because we're, you know, our values, we care so much about our values, our higher values. Well, great. I'm a Southerner. I grew up in the rural South. I grew up on the edge of a small town. I went to public schools. I was in church every Sunday. I'm much more comfortable, frankly, in red state America than I am anyplace else. And that white guy who votes against our liberal programs is voting against his economic self-interest and for a set of values. And if you listen to what he says, he'll tell you, I know that this may wind up hurting me, but I don't want you taking somebody else's money and trying to bribe me with their money so you can undermine my parenting decisions. I want my kids to be independent. If my kid makes a mistake, I don't want you taking stolen money to bail them out. I have a value of respecting other people's property. I have a value of respecting good parenting, and I don't like you stealing people's money to undermine my parenting decisions. Now listen, that's a value. Doesn't help you with China. Doesn't help you with a whole set of problems. But when we come to people and say, you're just too stupid to know your own interest, and when us smart liberal folks on the coast are going to tell you what your interests are, it's highly offensive. It also makes it impossible to partner. Because I tell you what, if you insult somebody, it doesn't matter if you're right or wrong. If you've offended them, I go the other way. And I say, well, I understand. And I believe that you are making decisions that both reflect your economic interests, as do I, and your values, as do I. But let's talk about your values and how we can make your family stronger. But you got to go around. And so I'm going to tell you, the worst thing that you can do to somebody is to tell them that they're stupid. And I think the liberal elite on these coasts, I cannot tell you how many times. I'm going to go on about this. You guys cut out the radio if you need to. But this is important here. I remember in 2004, I had a son this big, now he's 11. He's a little burrito baby at the time. And I was with a bunch of other progressive folk, and they had just reelected George W. Bush, and somebody called the middle of this country dumb fuckistan. And everybody laughed and thought it was the funniest thing they ever heard, dumb fuckistan, because people didn't vote for John Kerry. And I knew in that moment that I'm not a part of some very important thing on the left.
But at The Nation, I remember that moment. And I said, blaming the people is a politics that is dead on arrival. The elites probably failed, but people are not the ones to blame. So I think you're absolutely right, Van, but I also think we're seeing a moment, and I'll say very briefly, that there's a GOP crack-up we're witnessing, where you have the country club establishment Republicans not clear what is going on with a more populist base. You were talking about social values, but I guarantee you Donald Trump could go to Ohio and talk trade, 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 and do real well with a whole set of people, right, left, center, transpartisan. So I think it's an interesting moment where there is a group, there are people within the Republican Party who you could argue have voted against their own self-interest, as white liberals have, who are waking up and saying, wait a minute, I'm not getting my share from these country club kind of Republicans. But I agree with you, a politics that blames the people first is not going anywhere.
I may have misspoken. Just hear me out here. This is very painful for me. I just don't think you can lead a country you don't love. Mm. And I think that there's a part of the left rhetoric that doesn't love the middle of the country, doesn't see them in their pain, doesn't see them in their beauty, and almost sort of kind of almost cast them out in a way. Like you, and I feel like that is painful.
There are different lefts, there are different rights. My husband is from Owensboro, Kentucky. We go every year. You know, you get to know people. We went down there a couple years ago.
Kentucky.
We went to Owensboro, which is not Louisville, and we spoke at the Museum of Big Trucks and Cars. And I was worried. I mean, you know, I'm editor of The Nation. How would it go? And part of what happens, and I'll stop just very briefly, is as you talk to people, you find common interests. You may not agree on everything, but the idea that everyone has to agree on everything, I've never believed in, but you're able to talk. So much of our media doesn't talk to people. It makes them spectators. It makes them feel cynical. It cuts them out, right? So I'm just saying there's a lot swirling around in this issue.
Van, I'd like to speak on behalf of coastal liberals. because I'm sure that there are some who feel better, perhaps, than people in the great middle or south. But actually, my experience is that there is a widespread sense, whether it's coastal liberals or southern conservatives or Midwestern Tea Partiers, of powerlessness. And that sense of powerlessness is almost universal in America right now, except for a very, very small elite. Now, I'd like to also put in a good word on behalf of the baby boomers, who have also come in for some discussion tonight. I was born in 1946. So was Bill Clinton. So was George W. Bush. So was Donald Trump. Anybody who was anybody was born in 1946.
That's very funny. That's good.
And a lot of the boomers, political learnings and the kind of formative political leaders were not about powerlessness. They were about power. Mm-hmm. I mean, we learned that through organization, through the civil rights movement, through the anti-Vietnam War movement, we could actually make change. And I think that what Americans need more than ever before, and certainly since the 60s, is a sense of efficacy, a sense that they can make a difference. I've been teaching for the last 35 years young people between the ages of 18 and 25. I have never, in 35 years, encountered a young generation of 18 to 25-year-olds that is more idealistic and more determined to give back to this country than the current one that I'm teaching right now. So I am very optimistic, but I think that we can build the kind of coalition that we've all been hinting around, but it has got to be based on a sense of mutual interdependence, the need for us to have a voice, to overcome a power structure that is becoming completely unconnected, disconnected from almost everyone, including coastal liberals. Did you hear me? Did you hear me? Sometimes I feel like I don't have a voice.
That's good. So, another question. Let's talk remedies now. Here we are. What are the metrics of success that you look for in tax reform? For example, Ted Cruz's proposal of a flat tax. Jump it.
Go for it.
Yeah, exactly.
There are a number of tax proposals out there that are, in a time of raging inequality, so extraordinarily stupid that almost words fail me. The idea of a flat tax, for example. A flat tax necessarily means that high-income people will be paying less and low-income people will be paying more. That's how you get to a flat tax. So don't have anybody tell you differently. That is going to aggravate inequality in this country. It's as bad as trickle-down economics. It's as bad as austerity economics. It's another version of voodoo, doo-doo economics.
My God.
Have I found my voice?
Found your voice.
I think on the more positive side, I did love it when Bernie Sanders said in the debate that President Eisenhower was far more radical than he was. When you consider it was the 91% marginal tax rate on people making over 400,000, which would be equivalent of about 3 million today, I am passionate about something called the Robin Hood tax. It's not new, but it also has transpartisan support, the conservative finance minister in Germany. But the idea of it is a small tax on speculation, stocks, trade, currency, and take that Wall Street money and reinvest it in Main Street, in rebuilding a middle class. And the other small, simple thing is tax work, unearned income at the same rate or much higher than work. It is just insane that you have these hedge fund tax loopholes still in our system. So I think Bob Reich, if we put him here tonight and closed him in the cabinet, could come forward with a manifesto, but quickly, we all know in many ways what the solution is. It's the political, it's the inequality of political power that holds back what could be done to make this a far more rational, far more fair system.
We've received a number of questions just about capitalism and a capitalist system, and I'll just put it in this one here. Isn't income inequality just the unfortunate reality of a capitalist system?
This is Bob's book.
Well, yes, but yes, some level, but you can get to a level where the system itself seizes up and you can have, you know, tremendous problems. I think that's probably where we are. You know, one of the things I just want to say is that something's happening here in Northern California that I think we haven't discussed. You know, we're moving into this digital age now. And it's not unusual to see, since we're talking about the millennials, it's not unusual to see a 23, 26, 31-year-old multi-millionaire wandering around here in the Mission District. for people who are listening to this on the radio, the Mission District used to be a working class Latino neighborhood where I spent my 20s, and it's now not. So I do think that there's something happening, and I don't think that we should rush past it. You know, there is this technology dimension, and I don't think that our conception of the liberal conception, our conception of the state has caught up yet. I still think that we primarily think of the state as a redistributor, that we still are thinking this kind of industrial age capitalism where the means of production is in the hands of a certain set of people, and they're going to abuse the workers and the environment and hoard all the money. And the state's going to step in, benevolently carried along by popular movements to redistribute wealth and push back on the environmental destruction and all sorts of stuff. And I just look at what's actually happening in the economy. And the one thing I can say is that the future is not being written in laws in Washington, D.C. The future seems to be written in code in Silicon Valley, and it gets shipped every day fast. And the ability of the state as we have known it to catch up, let alone to keep up, to me is quite dubious. And so for me, the popular movements become much, much more important to me in how we actually get change. I don't just mean popular movements to elect candidates. I mean popular movements to do battle on a daily basis, to deploy technology in different ways on a daily basis, to connect with each other on a daily basis, and to be inside of the actual moment where change is going exponentially. I don't think the left should anymore say, we are trying to make change. I think we sound weird when we say that. Silicon Valley is making change. You've got revolutions happening in biotech and nanotech, in drones and smart screens. You're going to be able to prick your finger, put it on a slide, put it into a machine, and print out a copy of your liver in 4 years. That's real. When you have that much change, our goal is not to make change. Change is coming faster than we know. Our goal should be to make change work for our people, to make change our friend, to find a way, whether we can use the government or not, I'd worry about this political coalition talk, whether we can get the government on our side or not, to find ways for popular movements to make change our friend, and where government can be captured, great. But I don't think we should leave these communities to the tender mercies of the market or of the state in an age like this.
No, the talk about capitalism makes me think of why Bob has been traversing the country, going to the heartland. Your book is about capitalism. So I'd love to hear your thoughts. There are many different kinds of capitalism, so.
I think the point is that there really is not a division between government and free market. And if we accept that division, we've given away most of the argument. Government is creating the market. In Silicon Valley, if there weren't a patent system or an intellectual property system that is enforced by the government, where patents and trademarks continue to get longer and longer, where it's harder and harder to litigate against them, intellectual property is a central subject of the Trans-Pacific mm-hmm. Partnership, where the power over networks in terms of standard platforms and standard software portals is getting larger and larger and in the hands of a smaller and smaller number of companies, and antitrust is not being used as it could be used. I think these are all very central questions that have to do with the structure of the market.
Yeah.
So I don't draw the distinction between government and market. And I think that part of empowering people is understanding how government is shaping the market. And it's not even a question of the size of government. It's not a large government or small government. It's whether the government is working for us, or it's working for a smaller and smaller minority of people who have a greater and greater degree of power over it.
But doesn't this that bring where, the lobbyists in?
I mean, yeah, but this is a big piece of inequality. Because the lobbyists and also political contributions and also the power of a relatively small minority to get experts, university experts.
Think tanks?
And think tank experts to substantiate whatever they want in congressional hearings elsewhere. That power, all of that power, has a compounding effect on the way the market is organized. It tilts the market in the direction, increasingly, of the wealthy and the wealthy institutions of society. And as the market is tilted in that direction, you see that consequence is for the wealthy to have even more power, and the large institutions, the large corporations, mm-hmm. and Wall Street to even gain more power over the market. And that compounding gets worse and worse. It's a vicious cycle that unless we understand it and attempt to reverse it through countervailing power, mm-hmm. We are not going to accomplish much. I couldn't agree with you more, all of you, about the importance of grassroots organization. But grassroots organization is no substitute for understanding and recapturing the central institutions of our society.
Yes,
that's right.
So one of the questions follows up on that. Corporations United, I mean Citizens United.
Corporations.
So
that's good.
We have a couple of questions about what is to be done to reverse that decision. Do we need a constitutional amendment? And one question is, what's the possibility of even getting support from Republicans to overturn that decision?
So my colleague John Nichols argues that the movement to repeal Citizens United is one of the most vibrant grassroots movement in this country. I mean, 15 states, 600 cities have moved to issue repeal, to amend Citizens United. Obviously, we need a different Supreme Court. And this election is critical. I mean, the next president will have the power, most likely, you know more about this, to appoint three justices. My colleague John Nichols also writes, when he writes about this, we must move immediately to repeal or amend Citizens United. I said, John, you gotta give people points along the road. You know, but because in my city, public financing, 6-1, has not only elected a mayor who ran on the most ambitious anti-inequality agenda we had seen, let's not forget, he's having a lot of trouble, but he did some good things. But the city council, because of public financing, has an African-American woman leader, there are 7 women in that city council, radical political voices who would not have been elected without that. So I think public financing empowers people. It's not just limiting money. It empowers people who might not otherwise be able to run. A cashier in Maine, a waitress, a sheriff, not a sheriff. But, you know, people from movements. Zephyr Teachout, an interesting anti-corruption, trust-busting candidate, ran with very little money, with some public financing, and gave Andrew Cuomo a run for his political electoral life. So I think there are ways to do it, but the Citizens United decision, and not just the Citizens United decision, Justice, there were others that have now compounded and dismantled what remained, has left us in a place where 158 families, the New York Times reported last month, have contributed half of the campaign funding so far in this election. So I think the politics of power inequality, you begin with public financing, you build out, and I think in cities and states across this country, you can begin to chip away at Citizens United.
I just want to say briefly, though, our opponents have one strategy. It's big money in, little people out. That's their approach to elections. Big money in, little people out. We have a split where you have one part of our movement that talks about big money, and then you have the other part that talks about the Voting Rights Act. We don't talk as much about Citizens United. We talk about the fact of the Voting Rights Act. Everybody went to see the movie Selma. That legislation that they fought and died for has been destroyed by the Supreme Court. And so when you have us over here marching for our basic right to vote and others talking about big money, we've got to pull that together. We should have one agenda, which is big money out, little people in.
Well, the Supreme Court, remember, we're talking about 5 of 9 justices who have been responsible for the shameful Shelby decision, ban that you were just referring to, for Citizens United. And then let's not forget, years ago, not that many years ago, was Buckley versus Valeo, that where the Supreme Court found that money is the equivalent of speech. Now, not only are corporate, you know, to conceive somehow that corporations are people and money is speech, talk about the triumph of big corporations over little people. We've got to get one vote. Of 5 votes, we've got to get one vote changed. This is not impossible. Katrina, you are 100% right. The next president, I think one of the biggest issues in terms of this upcoming election is who is going to get to be president. I don't generally support tests that are kind of, you know, you can only be a Supreme Court justice if you stand for this one thing or promise this one thing. But I do believe that the next Supreme Court justice, in order to be nominated and confirmed, has got to pledge to vote against Citizens United and repeal it.
So let's talk minimum wage. Are you in favor raising the minimum wage? If so, what should it be?
15.
Nation interns making 15 an hour. But Bob, you know, Hillary Clinton cited, was it Alan Krueger in the debate? I mean, there are debates about regional numbers. I don't know what your latest thinking. I think 15 is the way to go, and I think we see it moving, obviously, because of the power of movements. And by the way, we haven't talked about this, the power of cities and states. At a time when Washington is in gridlock, Seattle, the great coalition in Seattle, and in other cities, it's moved like wildfire in the best sense of the word.
Yeah, cities and states are moving on the minimum wage. They're also moving, Katrina, on issues that you brought up a moment ago, that is public financing. Maine recently, Ohio, Connecticut. They're moving on anti-gerrymandering.
Right.
Public, you know, public commissions. California, one of the great things that we did here in California was get districting out from under the politicians. I'm very proud to be the chairman of a national organization called Common Cause, which has did a lot of work and is now focusing on the states on many of these issues. With regard to $15 an hour minimum wage, let me just say this. I understand the position that says, well, cost of living is different in different parts of the country, and therefore, one place a $15 minimum wage might be too much for another place. But we don't make that kind of distinction when it comes to worker safety minimum standards, or child labor minimum standards, or any other moral issue with regard to minimum decency in America. And I think that given that the minimum wage in 1968 adjusted for inflation would today be $10.60, and that's not adjusting for the increase in productivity, the dramatic increase in American workers' productivity, even low-wage workers. If you adjust for both inflation and productivity, the minimum wage would be far higher than $15 an hour right now. And so $15 should be a national, minimally decent wage for Americans.
Just a couple other things about minimum wage. There are still some groups of workers who are excluded from minimum wage protections. Well, up until about a month ago, 2 million home care workers were excluded from minimum wage and overtime protections because of that 1930s legacy of racial exclusion in the labor laws. And this Department of Labor actually moved forward on a rule change that brought those 2 million workers under protections. Yes. Yeah. I think it's one of the most important victories for low-wage workers of the Obama administration, actually. But there are still workers, people with disabilities, who are working, who are essentially still excluded from minimum wage protections. There's a little clause called 14C, which allows for some companies and even nonprofits to pay people with disabilities below minimum wage. And we have a tipped minimum wage, which hasn't been increased. I think it's $2.90. And so there are still lots of ways in which we need to also fix and plug the Swiss cheese of what is minimum wage and secure it, in addition to raising it to 15. So I just want to, so there's a campaign led by the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United for one fair wage, to eliminate the tipped minimum wage altogether and raise us all.
So, Katrina, there was some reference made, and this is just going to be a quick question to ask you. There was some reference made to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, we heard it mentioned, for which President Obama is campaigning. You have called it anti-American. So why
did I call it anti-American? This is a question Robert Rice should be addressing. No, I mean, I think part of one of the un-American aspects, I would argue, of the way the treaty was sold was how secretive it was. But this is how trade treaties have been sold through time. Secretive, non-transparent, the incentives in it for corporations to be unpatriotic and move out of this country. At its root, though, what I've always fought against is the view that the progressive left is anti-globalization. It's not. We covered Seattle, we covered the fights against WTO, we covered the fights for fair globalization. The question is globalization for whom, on whose behalf, how? And Bob referred to the patent laws, things, I mean, the intellectual property protections, the arbitration secrecy, the lack of access for ordinary citizens to know how they're being shafted by these trade deals, which have contributed to the stagnation of wages over the last 40, 50 years. In my mind, I don't know if anti-American, but it's the worst of America. It's not the best of our traditions. I think the fight still goes on, but this was a case where we saw the Wall Street wing of the party assert its strength, its power, and the president worked hard and overtime to sell it and got into a fight with, I would argue, though Bernie Sanders is contending for this title, the leader of the populist wing of the Democratic Party, Senator Warren, who did not back down and spoke articulately and effectively about the reasons why against this, but reasons why she could see other kinds of trade agreements.
We have time for one last question now. We've come to the end of the program, so I'm going to pose one last question to each of you. If you were elected the next president of the United States, within your first 100 days, name one thing that you would do to end income and or wealth inequality in America. Who wants to go first? Bob.
Get big money out of politics.
So you're going to have to give us a little more.
Oh.
So what step would you take?
The key to all of this, from a standpoint of what this nation can be and what we want, whether we're talking about a coalition of populists from the left and right, whether we're talking about a new set of grassroots initiatives, or whether we're talking about retaking and reclaiming our democracy, we can only do it if we get big money out of politics. This is the key. This is the keystone. It's not the be-all and end-all, but it is the first preliminary step, because if we want to do anything on any of the other issues we've talked about, a single payer, or free public education, or the minimum wage, or whatever you want to begin looking at, you can't do it if the game is rigged, and it is rigged. I've been there, I've seen the rigging. I've tried to fight against the rigging, and I started out in 1967 as an intern for Robert F. Kennedy, and there wasn't all that much rigging then. Washington was a rather poor and seedy place, but it's got progressively wealthier to the point where the five counties surrounding the District of Columbia, three of them are among the wealthiest counties in the United States. When I started in Washington, only 6% of retiring members of Congress went on to become lobbyists because there wasn't that much money in being a lobbyist. Now, 50% of retiring members of Congress, half of them, become lobbyists because there's so much money. Washington is a glittering emerald city. We've got to get big money out of that city and out of every state capital.
So now, if we could quickly hear from the rest of you, what would you do in your first 100 days?
Family care, a new system to support the caregiving needs of families that would allow it to be more affordable and also improve the quality of caregiving jobs.
Ben. Right.
I know we only have 1 minute left, but they're just gonna have to edit. So I would, ending mass incarceration is the most important thing, I think, that could be done to make it possible for 40 million African Americans to even have a shot. We have we've not spoken as much about it as I think that we should in these discussions about the economy. So I just have to say this. You hear over and over again, 5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's 25% of the world's prisoners, which means one out of every four people on planet Earth who are locked up anywhere in the world, one out of four with their hands behind bars tonight, are locked up in the United States. We only have 5% of the world's population. And those are disproportionately African-American, Latino, Native American, underrepresented minority, and almost all underrepresented Asian, and almost all poor. It is now better to be rich and innocent than poor and guilty in this country. That's where we are. And so but those numbers do not tell the full story. One out of every four African-American men now is predicted, and some say one out of three, to have a prison record by the time that they're an adult. One out of three. That is a repeat of the dehumanization of the enslavement, of the dehumanization of Jim Crow. And the idea that this can be happening in our country and we continue to act like it's okay or normal, I think is something that we've got to dial up opposition to. There are safe, smart, bipartisan ways to roll back mass incarceration. They're happening some places, but not enough places. But this has become, and I want to be very clear, this has become the signature defining issue for the African-American community, period. And you're talking about a population, if you're a Democrat, in order for any presidential candidate to win as a Democrat, African-Americans have to support that candidate 60%. Oh, no, I'm sorry. 70%. Oh, no, I'm sorry. 80%. Oh, no, no, I'm sorry. 90%. Oh, no, 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 I'm sorry. 92 to 94%. You have a political party, the Democratic Party, that has to have near unanimous support from our community. And we have to climb over obstacle after obstacle after obstacle just to vote. You see African Americans standing in long lines in the rain to vote. And we elect a party that until very recently wouldn't even break its breath to talk about the issue, and in fact, was on the wrong side of this issue for way too long. And so I want to say very, very clearly, for a while, the Latino community has 1,000 problems, but for them, immigration is number one. Progressive women have 1,000 problems, but for them, choice is number one. The African American community has 1,000 problems, if not 1,001, but for us, mass incarceration and where you stand on locking up an entire generation of African Americans for stuff that we know kids are doing on college campuses right now is the number one issue. And anybody, I don't care who you are, I don't care what you did in 1963 or 2009 or yesterday, if you grab a microphone and you say you are a progressive and you don't speak about this issue with some passion and some heart and some concern and some care as if it were your children under this level of threat, you cannot and should not count on the quiet support of African Americans. The Obama era of black silence is over. That era is over. Look, I feel horrible, personally horrible. I started out my career working on this stuff. You got Guy Saperstein on the front row working on this stuff for years and for decades. And we failed over and over again to challenge the Democrats to do better, to force the Democrats to stop chasing after fear-mongering and racism and scoring political points off of our community's backs. And that is why you're going to see more, not less, more African-American militancy on these questions. You're going to see more African-American scholarship on these questions. And I beg everybody in this room to, if you hear somebody saying on your thread or anyplace else, what are these people doing? They're ungrateful. They're uppity. They need to sit down. They need to shut me a part of this. Never again. We are not going to go quietly. This is getting worse, not better. And we need the support of all of our allies. We have been there. The African-American, I'm going to keep talking, the African-American community, this is very important. The African-American community has been there on immigrant rights. It would have been very easy for black folks to come out and say, these damn immigrants are stealing our jobs. You have not heard that. The Obama coalition includes the Latino community, and black leadership defends immigrants. The black community could have been very easily moved to be against the LGBT movement. Our churches are not in the right place on this, but you have not seen any prominent African-American leadership attacking lesbians and gays in 10 years because the black leadership got people behind the door and said, you shut up. These people are a part of this coalition. Latinos, Native Americans, the African-Americans have supported the environmental agenda more than the white community. The entire black congressional caucus voted for cap and trade. That's better than the progressive caucus. The greenest caucus in the House on cap and trade was the black caucus. We have been there for every constituency down the line. And we insist that people be there for us this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, President Jones.
Very briefly, our priorities are skewed. If we're going to really tackle inequality, there are many good ideas here, but I would say we must end endless war as America's engagement with the world. America's policing of the world has detracted from the real security needs, tackling inequality, redefining security at home. And one thing the president could do in the first 2 hours is understanding a just transition, but close the 800 bases ringing this world. Say, I'm not going to modernize nuclear weapons. I'm going to begin to bring them down to a level, take them off high target alert, but just understand what endless war has done to damage the principles which could be deployed to end inequality in this country.
Before we close out, I just want to take a moment to recognize Katrina Vandenhoevel.
Yeah.
Thank you. You are a heroine.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Arjun.
Well, thanks to our panelists, Robert Reich, professor and former U.S. Secretary of Labor.
That was great, Ken. That was great, Ken. Also great. Always.
Thanks to Ai-Jin Poo, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Thank you to Van Jones, former White House Special Advisor for Green Jobs. And thank you to Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation. We also thank everyone in attendance tonight. Tonight's program has been co-presented by The Nation magazine, the conscience of our country for 150 years and counting. I am Judge Ladaris Cordell, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.